Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. This is our 10:30 session, and I'll introduce the other two members of the panel for those who don't know us. Judge Walker, Sue Walker, is on my right, and Senior Judge Bill Brigham is on my left, and I'm Ann Gardner. We have two cases set for oral argument this morning, and then four more that will be submitted, but without oral argument. And I will ask our clerk to call the first case, please.
The court will now call in the interest of AEA's child, and may it please the court, Mr. Mark Winnebus to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Lisa Marquis to argue for the appellate.
Thank you. Mr. Winnebus.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Good morning. My name is Mark Winnebst, and I am counsel for the appellant Dan Adhami in this matter. I also have with me Latrice Andrews, who is my associate, and she is the primary author of the briefing that the court has before it on this matter. This is an appeal from a ruling on counter motions to modify that were filed after a final decree which was entered in the 367th Judicial District Court of Denton County. Judge Lee Gabriel presided over the trial at the end of 2007, and the decree was signed in 2008. In that decree, Judge Gabriel made a specific finding that this was a high conflict case, and she made particular rulings based upon that, both in appointing a parenting coordinator and also making specific rulings about educational matters for the child, because the conflict involved educational matters. In the counter motions to modify, both parties sought the exclusive right to be the person in charge of the decisions regarding the child's educational matters. Prior to that, it was a right that was shared by both of them. After the trial in this matter, which was held last August, neither party was able to prove a material change in circumstances. In fact, if you'll see in the record, even in the argument, at the final argument of the case, the argument made by the appellee's counsel, she said that the only change was the child had not been accepted into Green Hill. And that was one of the specific provisions of the decree, that if the child did get accepted, he would go to Green Hill. Yet in its ruling, the court ruled that the exclusive right for educational decisions should go to the appellee, the mother of the child. And that's where this appeal lies. It's our position that...
But didn't you also plead that there had been a change in circumstances, a material change in circumstances?
The pleadings were made by both sides, yes, Your Honor.
If the pleadings are made by both sides, that fact is not even an issue, is it? I mean, you both made that pleading as a jurisdictional prerequisite to invoke the trial court's jurisdiction over the motion to modify. So how is that fact even an issue?
Your Honor, I think the case law still requires that there be evidence put on as to a material change in circumstances, and that when you have contraindicating pleadings over an issue as to motion to modify, and you have answers on file also that deny the same issue, that the admission is not unequivocal. And therefore, without that admission being unequivocal, it still requires evidence from both parties.
What is not unequivocal about this? There's a material and substantial change of condition filed in the case by the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor. Both parties said that as to several issues.
What is unequivocal about that?
But both parties also put in answers that denied that same fact. And so you have a pleading that says it is a material change, and you have an answer that says we deny that. And so I think with the competing admissions and the competing denials, it's not unequivocal, so you have to have evidence as to the circumstances.
When you plead a fact that's a prerequisite to obtaining relief, if you didn't plead that fact, you would not... You couldn't file a motion to modify. There would be no basis for filing a motion to modify without pleading a substantial change in circumstances. And so I'm saying when the parties plead an affirmative fact as a jurisdictional prerequisite to invoke the trial court's jurisdiction over a motion, and both sides pleaded, how is that almost not like a stipulation, almost not akin to a stipulated fact?
because there are several matters which each party, including the education, there was a matter as to modification as to child support that was pled by one side and denied by another. There was a matter as to desiring to change the visitation parameters, which was pled by one side and denied by the other. And so that by each side making pleadings of conclusory matters and each side making a denial of the same conclusory matters, there's not an unequivocal statement that is proven without needing the underlying evidence to come into play. And I think that the failure to plead it would only be fatal if, in fact, you go to trial and no one complains about it and raises that for the first time later on appeal. I think the case law says that that's too late to raise the failure to plead it. And having proven it in cases where it wasn't pled properly, it was still allowed to stand. In this case...
Excuse me. I'm going to get my question in. I can understand where one your side is claiming there was a material and substantial change based on what your client thinks are certain facts, and she's claiming others. That the change in circumstances is based on others. Can you distinguish the sides, please?
Well,
on the issue of exclusive right to determine the education.
Well, I think what it is that both sides made a pleading to that effect, and then when they put on their evidence, what they put on their evidence was that this was a highly conflicted, disparate parenting styles, that they had a major conflict as to education and how each parent went about that education, and that the child was still in public school now and he had not got admitted to Green Hill yet. And all those factors existed at the time of the initial divorce. It was a highly conflicted matter at that time. They had disparate parenting styles at that time. The child was not in Green Hill at that time. And the only thing that had changed between the time of the divorce and the time of the filing and finally hearing the motion to modify is that the child had gotten older and the child had not gotten accepted into Green Hill. And that's why in our brief we rely upon the case of Zeifman versus Michaels, because in that case the child in that case had gotten accepted into a private school, which had been outside of the determination by the decree as to the educational plans for the child. And the court found merely getting accepted into that school, that wasn't a changed circumstance. This decree.
If the father's position now is that there was no material or substantial change in circumstance, then isn't the motion to modify filed by the father a frivolous pleading?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that at the time that these filings were made, that there were several matters that the people were trying to address. And I think over time, as they went through their case, that perhaps the facts bore out that they didn't have the evidence to support some of these matters, the main one probably being the request for education. So there's other matters that had been requested, changing the visitation arrangements so that the child would spend a full week with each parent instead of the 225 arrangement they currently have, because that's what was the 225 was causing some of the conflict in the weekly homework assignments for the child. So there's other matters that requested that wouldn't make it frivolous merely because they were unable to prove this particular part of the request. In this case, I think that this court has to review the case from a standard of review of abuse of discretion. The appellant made a specific request for findings of fact and conclusions of law, and after requesting those a second time, the court issued findings of fact and conclusions of law. And what I would set forth to this court is that the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were finally issued by the court are both insufficient legally and they are insufficient factually. And I think this court needs to review each of those. And in making that review, it will make the determination, because there's insufficient evidence to support the determination of the court, they will then be able to see that the court abuses discretion in applying that discretion to the evidence. This court expressed clearly in the record a bias against the appellant, stating that the appellant had demonstrated an unlikable quality that was irritating the court and was not going to bode well for the client, for the appellant's requested relief. Then the findings bear out that bias. I would put forth to the court, as you look at the evidence, specifically the voluminous emails that are between the parties, as well as the testimony of Mr. Adhami, that the parties in this case are both naturalized United States citizens. They speak English as a second language. And I think what that leads to, and the point I'm trying to make here, is something that I've experienced with my own family that are for naturalized citizens, and that's that when they translate very literally. Even though they're fluent in English, their translations come across very literal. And literal can sometimes be very gruff, very blunt. Sometimes it appears tactless, especially in writing. But for the most part, it's always honest. It's always truthful. And I think as you go through each of the findings of fact that this court found, and if you take a look at the evidence that is before the court, both in the testimony and in the written matters, you may see that. But in no point do you find evidence that supports the specific findings. I think that there's a conclusory finding and finding number two of a material and substantial change in circumstances, and yet there's no evidence in this record of that change. I think all of the situations between these parents that are existing now existed at the time of the divorce. The conflict, the disparate parenting styles, the educational concerns, the involvement with the education. The only thing that has changed is the child didn't get accepted into Green Hill Academy the first time he applied. I think withdrawing the chance to go to Green Hill as a moot matter, which is number six on the conclusions of law, does not follow from any finding of fact. Neither party requested that to be removed from the decree. That part of the decree was a well-reasoned decision by Judge Gabriel, and it's not something that needs to come out. And so by removing that, that was an abuse of discretion. If you look specifically at the findings of fact contained under number 11, in fact, the court stated at the motion for new trial that he added some of his own findings rather than relying purely on the findings provided by the opposing party. The findings of fact 11A through G are nowhere supported by the record. In fact, the opposite of each one is what is supported by the evidence. That's what makes these findings both legally insufficient and factually insufficient.
Can I ask a question about Green Hill School? Taking that provision out, does that now prohibit either party from having the child apply again?
It doesn't prohibit them from applying, but by taking that provision out and by granting the mother the exclusive right to make educational decisions, if the child were to be accepted this coming year or next year or the year after that into Green Hill, she could have the right to say no. And I think part of the conflict and part of the fight at the time of the divorce is why that ended up in the decree, because of the father's concern that the child be get into a private school as soon as he was able because of the father's desire that he have a high level of education that could be provided there at Green Hill. So taking it out and providing her the exclusive right does make it to where it may not happen even though he gets accepted. I think if both parties remained equal in their rights to make the educational decisions and having Green Hill in there, if he gets accepted, then that's what the decree requires, that that's where he goes. And the decree also requires that the father pay for that. So it's not a matter of getting accepted and one side being unable to afford that going to the private school. The father's willing and able and wants to pay for it once he gets him into there. In addressing the findings of fact in Section 11, Section 11A talks about that the high conflict is due to improper conduct and condescending attitude of Mr. Adhami. I would ask this court anytime it reads anything about a condescending attitude that it take into consideration what I've talked about the literal speaking of people who speak English as a second language. You can see in all of Mr. Adhami's communications with the mother of the child, Ms. Adib, he's informing her of events, informing her of homework obligations, informing her of matters that need to happen at school, asking her about things that are missing, asking her about homework, asking her or letting her know things that need to happen for homework to go forward, inviting her to birthday parties, telling her matters that she should attend at school or matters that need to be brought to school for the child. And all of these emails support that he is trying to communicate and trying to do things in the best interest of the child. Most importantly, I think the court should look at number 11F and number 11G. 11F talks about conduct intended to alienate the mom from the child. There's no expert testimony in this case about alienation. What you have are a plethora of emails inviting the mom to events, inviting her to birthday parties, notifying her of doctor appointments, telling her what happened at doctor appointments, explaining to her how they need to both see the child, explaining to the child explaining to the mom how he explained to the child that's important for the child to stay at the mom's house even if he gets upset. Nothing at all regarding alienation. More importantly, number 11G, it uses the language vulgar, profane, obscene, indecent. If you look throughout these emails, there's not one vulgarity, not one profanity, not one obscenity. There's no indecent language used by Mr. Adhami at all. What you have is brutal honesty at times. What you have is blunt, gruff statements that are indicative of someone that is speaking English of a second language. But all of the statements are completely true. All of the statements are being made by Mr. Adhami in his concerns for the best interest of his child. What we're asking the court today to do is to reverse the decision of this court on this matter regarding education and render a decision that should not be modified in this decree. I believe there was a modification made to the temporary orders regarding child support because the child had not got into Green Hill, and that's something that hasn't been challenged necessarily since the temporary orders. So the modification keeping child support in place for my client is something that perhaps should stand, but I think a decision should be rendered that keeps both parties equally in place as to the decisions regarding the child's education.
I have a question about the findings of fact set forth in finding of fact number 11 that you were discussing, A through G.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've challenged those findings in your brief. So even if we agree with you that there's insufficient evidence to support those findings, aren't there other grounds supporting the best interest determination by the trial court that the education situation should be modified, that being the child's failure to gain admission to Green Hill and the child's educational needs, such things like that, that have nothing to do with those findings of fact? In other words, even if those findings of fact were set aside, what relief does that get you?
Your Honor, I think that when you set aside those findings of fact, you're looking towards implied findings from the record, and the findings from the record will show that both parties are highly involved with the child's educational decisions, that my client is much more involved than the mom, and that Mr. Adhami goes out of his way looking out for the child's best interest to try to help him and try to make things happen for him and work with him at school. That the findings that you will see when you have to imply them are the exact opposite of a ruling that would take away the right to be involved with the educational decisions by Mr. Adhami. That by getting rid of these findings that are legally and factually insufficient, that's the first step in an abuse of discretion review. The next step is to say, okay, if we don't have sufficient evidence, did the court abuse its discretion and make its ruling?
But the two prongs, as I understand it, that need to be established are material and substantial change in circumstance and best interest. So these findings of fact could only go to best interest, correct?
Well, the findings of fact in number 11, yes, but in number okay. 2, there's a conclusory
right.
statement of material.
Right, and I understand your argument on that point totally. So these findings of fact that you're challenging in number 11, A through G, would go to the best interest determination. And my question is, isn't there other evidence in the record supporting a best interest determination?
I think there is, but I think it supports to not make a change. The evidence that establishes that these findings are incorrect also establishes that the decision by the court should have been to leave both parties equally responsible for the child's educational decisions and to leave the right to go to Green Hill if it gets accepted in the decree.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, we'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Lisa Marquis. I am the attorney for the appellee, Gita Adib, and I was also her trial attorney in the case that was heard back in August. I'd like to first bring to the court's attention a very recent decision issued by the Dallas Court of Appeals. It was issued on February 28th of this year in the interest of LCL, and it specifically addressed the issue of one party's allegation of a material and substantial change of circumstances constituting a judicial admission as to that same element, i.e. a material and substantial change of circumstances, when both parties were pleading for changes regarding conservatorship. Many of the cases that Mr. Winups referenced involved different issues being, modification being sought of different issues, whether possession and access, support, or conservatorship. And the courts are clear that pleading a material and substantial change of circumstance as to possession and access does not necessarily satisfy the requirement of a material and substantial change of circumstance as it relates to conservatorship or support. And that case cited Thompson versus Thompson, saying admissions in trial pleadings are regarded as judicial admissions in the case that pleading was filed, require no proof of the admitted fact, and authorize the introduction of no evidence to the contrary. So it's our position that Mr. Adami is barred from now claiming that there wasn't a material and substantial change of circumstance. This case started in 2010 by Mr. Adami filing a petition to modify, and only after a full day trial, my client incurring $22,000 in attorney's fees and a decision adverse to his request, did he now claim there was no material and substantial change of circumstance. In our brief, we referenced that we believe that either there was or it was a frivolous filing, one or the other. I was not involved in the original divorce, but it was a high conflict case, and the court appointed a parenting facilitator. Both parties testified at trial that that was not working, and the court removed her, which was one of the avenues for the parties to use to address their ongoing conflicts regarding education of the child. At the time of trial, the child was 4.5 years old. At the time of the divorce, the child was 4.5 years old. At the time of trial in August, he was going into the fourth grade. There had been one attempt for his admission into Green Hill, which was denied, and there was evidence and testimony by Mr. Adami that he blamed the mother for the child's inability to get into Green Hill. There was also testimony that no further attempts had been made to get the child into Green Hill since the time of the initial filing when he was going into first grade. In the case of In Re CCJ, again out of the Court of Appeals of Dallas in 2008, the court specifically found that the party's ongoing conflict as to educational matters since their divorce was entered, supported the finding of a material and substantial change of circumstance. The overriding issue in all of these cases is the best interest of the child. And if you've got parents who are in such a high level of conflict, the court has the ability and probably the duty to find some solution to reduce that conflict and get the child out of the middle of it and do what is in the best interest of the child. The parenting facilitation wasn't working. The court had the authority to come up with some other resolution to try to remove the child from this conflict. The evidence in the court's record shows several instances of change of circumstances. Yes, aging is one of them. Mr. Winnips references the case of Zeifman versus Michael. That case is very distinguishable from the case at hand because that case involved an agreed decree. Not only did the parties address which level of schools the children would go to as they aged, private versus public, it also had a mechanism in place for what to do if the parties could not agree. In that case, mom, after she went to the tiebreaker and didn't like the tiebreaker's decision, then filed her request to modify, seeking to have the exclusive right to make educational decisions. Very distinguishable in that situation is the dad did not file a counter petition to modify. There was no way to have a judicial admission by him of a material and substantial change of circumstance. And in that case, in a course of 2 pages, the Court of Appeals referenced the negotiated agreement of the parties in finding that what mom was claiming was a change of circumstances was not a change of circumstances. With respect to the language issue, there's lots of examples, and I just want to bring out one because I think it is a mischaracterization of the level of emails the type of emails that were going on between the parties. Mr. Adami read from an email that he had sent to my client in court and said, "I'm trying to figure out what is a good word to use for people like you. If I call you a mother, I think it would be an insult for every good mother in this world. If I call you a nanny, I think they spend more time with the kids than you, take care of kids that they take care of, and do more of the things for them than you have ever done for the child." Is that the brutal honesty that we want going on between parties. That is just one example of the emails that were read into the record, evidence before this court, that led the court to make the decision it made regarding the parental alienation. But even that finding is not dispositive of the issue related to the making of educational decisions for this child. The conflict is ongoing. The parenting facilitator did not resolve that. The inability of the parenting facilitator to resolve it could itself be a material and substantial change of circumstance to tell the court, we've got to do something else.
Did the parents attend the classes that they were ordered to attend within 60 days?
I believe so. In Denton County, that's only with respect to the divorce, and I was not.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't involved in the divorce, so I don't know if they did that or not. So I don't know, Your Honor. With respect to the issue of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, at no time did counsel for appellant request that the court file amended findings of fact and conclusions of law. In Gardner versus Gardner, the San Antonio Court of Appeals held that the appellant failed to preserve her complaint that the findings of fact were defective because after the trial court made the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the appellant did not request any additional findings of fact and conclusions of law. Counsel for appellant, that court goes on to say the trial court, as the fact finder, is the sole judge of the credibility of the witnesses and the weight to be given to their testimony. Counsel for appellant has asserted that there was no evidence to support the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and that's why they could raise it for the first time on appeal. However, to establish a no evidence finding, there can't even be a scintilla of evidence to support the finding, as held by the Texas Supreme Court and Holt Atherton Industries. There is evidence within the record in various places regarding the material and substantial change of circumstance, multiple entries in the record regarding the emails and the negative conversations between the parties via email. And most importantly, Your Honors, both sides submitted all of their exhibits by stipulation. Every email that the parties wanted in was in. At the conclusion of the trial, the court said, it's going to take me a few days to go through these emails and I will get a decision to you. We received that decision via email, I believe, September 1st or September 2nd, a few days after the trial concluded. And at the end of that trial, with respect to the issue of judicial bias, at the end of that trial, as is common, I have found, in litigated family law cases, the judge was mad at both parties. The judge chastised both parties for continuing their conflict, for continuing the fight, and for naively believing that the child wasn't getting caught in the middle of this. I know that when I walked out of that courtroom, I had no idea which way he was going to go. There was no indication as to a bias against one party or the other. And as far as other allegations, there's no record regarding the hearing on the motion for new trial, so many of the statements Mr. Winnup's references by the judge, there's no record of, and therefore nothing for this Court of Appeals to review on that issue. We're requesting that the court deny the appeal and leave the decision of the trial court as it stands. Thank you.
What is your client's position on Greenhill School about the judge removing the provision for the child attending the private school?
To be honest, I don't think she believes a child can get into Greenhill, and to keep that as an ongoing issue between the parties, she has some concern about what it does to the child if he keeps applying for admission and keeps getting denied admission, or if he gets in and can't compete with those other children. The child's in tutoring for reading, writing, and math. He struggles. The record shows there's a difference of opinion between the parties as to whether the child is even struggling, notwithstanding that he's in tutoring. So the parents have very different parenting styles, very different education styles, and to leave that issue in, my client is concerned, will just breed more conflict for the parties going forward.
Thank you very much. And now we're ready for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I believe right in the trial transcript, page 135 is where the judge specifically says that Mr. Adhami was irritating him and that it is not going to bode well for his request of relief. So I believe it's directly in the transcript where he expresses his bias directly against Mr. Adhami. As far as the LCL case that's just recently released from the Dallas Court of Appeals, that case involved family violence. It distinguishes it from this case and from most any other case because of the need to make a change that resulted from that family violence.
But on the issue of judicial admission, it does appear to be directly on point. It involves a judicial admission of substantial and material change in circumstances under 156.101, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. But at the same time, there's, if you look at footnote 31 in the reply brief that was filed, we cite several cases, including one, Snyder versus Gray, that involves custody matter, says they don't agree that respective pleadings stipulating to the effect that because the parties had respective pleadings alleging a material and substantial change, they do not need to prove up the key element in order to change a matter of custody. I think that the LCL case, it relies on a case, Delaney versus Shear, which is also one that has been questioned, and the Snyder versus Gray case talks about pleading up each point of your request of relief, and that the family violence in the LCL case overarches everything else that you requested in that case. As far as the filings being frivolous, this is something that should have been raised by the by the appellee at trial and never has been raised. So I don't think the issue of whether this is frivolous filing in this case is before this court. There's no evidence before this court that this child is in the middle of this conflict. All of the discussions and matters and emails between the parties are done directly between Mr. Adhami and Ms. Adib. Many of them later at night when the child's not awake or around. So there's no evidence that the child is being thrust into the middle of this. In fact, there's evidence of Mr. Adhami trying to involve the mom in birthday parties, in school events where both of them would be there and be present with the child and try to provide a unified front for that child. As far as the findings of fact issue, the findings of fact, by requesting them and requesting them a second time when they get made by the court, we've preserved our right to challenge them for legal and factual sufficiency. What we don't have a right to do, and what the case law cited by Appley states, is that we don't have a right to suggest other findings that should have been made. In order to do that, we should have submitted some and requested and say, make these findings, please. And when those findings weren't made, that we would then have a right to say, well, you need to make this one or that one. And we're not saying that. What we're saying is that the findings were made, and the implied findings that may exist from this record do not support the change that has been made. Once again, we would request the court reverse and render that the educational decision should be made by both parties in this case, that the child still be allowed to go to Green Hill if he gets accepted, and that the other relief requested by the parties be denied. Thank you,
counsel. Thank you to all counsel. I want to compliment you personally for excellent briefs on both sides. And we appreciate your arguments. Your case is submitted, and you are excused. We will take a 10-minute break for a change of panel for the next case.